Hello and welcome to episode 25 of After the Breach. We're your hosts, Jeff and Sarah, here from Friday Harbor on San Juan Island in Washington State. And joining us again today is Gary Sutton, our friend and colleague from across the border. Thanks for joining us, Gary.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on. It's been probably about a year since you were on.
The early episodes.
About that. Time flies. Yeah,
it's been too long, really, since we've done this or a Zoom happy hour.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to talk today about population of killer whales that we've mentioned a few times on past episodes, but haven't really gone into any depth and have some really cool reasons to talk in detail about them. They're the northern resident killer whales, and they are also a fish-eating population of killer whales. And Gary, you want to tell us a little bit? You've done some work lately with them, but maybe give us a little intro to who are the northern resident killer whales.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, my experience with killer whales on the coast was mostly with bigs and southern residents, but I've been really lucky since about 2021 when I joined OceanWise to spend some more time with northern resident killer whales, which are, you know, all the stories I read growing up and the books I read growing up all kind of focused around Blackfish Sound and Johnson Strait, and sort of the northeast corner of Vancouver Island was sort of the hub for killer whale research. And it all centered around these northern resident killer whales. And like our southern residents, these are salmon specialists, primarily feeding on Chinook, but typically their range is Campbell River all the way up to southern Alaska, with a lot of their time being spent on the north and central coast of British Columbia. And they're much like the southern residents in the sense that they travel in the big, large matrilineal groups. A little bit different in the sense that, you know, southern residents typically are with their whole pod almost all the time, although we have seen some fragmentation over the years, whereas northern residents often travel more in their matrilines, not always all together. However, recently we have had a visit from the what we call the A5 pod down here in the Salish Sea, which is made up of three different matrilines: the A23s, A25s, and A42s. And these three matrilines, or at least one of them anyway, have been a regular visitor to the Salish Sea, fairly regular in the winter months, but they're just for these brief encounters and typically on the Sunshine Coast and down towards Howe Sound. But I certainly haven't seen anything like this with them hanging around as much as they have over the past week and a half or so.
And for those of you who have been out with us or follow us or are familiar with the area where we do our whale watching trips, the Sunshine Coast and Howe Sound, that's up actually like just northwest of Vancouver, out of our typical range for tours, probably in range on our all day tours, but
just on the very edge of in range.
Yeah. And we've actually never been up there on a whale watching tour until very, very recently. And we'll get into that. I do have a question for you, Gary, and you may or may not know the answer to this, but this came up yesterday. Do we know if there's any relationship between those three matrilines? Obviously, they're in the same clan, but do we know anything about the relationship between them?
Yeah, that's something I'm not sure on. That would probably be a question for Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and maybe Jared Towers would be probably better to speak to about that.
Yeah, I was just curious if like A23 and A25 were what their relationship was, if anybody even knew.
Yeah, and I have no inkling.
and something that is different about the northern residents from the southern residents, obviously lots of differences, but one is that the northern resident population has multiple clans.
Yeah, so they have three different clans. So for southern resident killer whales, they are in one acoustic clan, so known as J clan, and that's J pod, K pod, L pod. Whereas northern residents, there are three acoustic clans, and that's A clan, G clan, and R clan.
Exactly.
And then you have multiple different pods within those clans.
Yeah, and so I actually, you know, when we it's been years now probably, but when we were seeing southern residents on our tours more frequently, we would talk about the different pods, you know, J pod, K pod, L pod, and some would inevitably go, well, is there an iPod? And then you could get into the Northern Residence. Yes, there is an iPod, and it predates, you know, Apple iPods. The OG iPod.
The OG iPod. I like that.
So,
and one of the cool things I find about, because they travel in sort of these more matrilineal groups rather than a big cohesive pod all the time, that their language and their dialects have been really kind of sussed out almost to the individual level. Mm-hmm. By places like Orca Lab, who will hear just on the hydrophone of whales coming into the area, and they can tell you exactly what family within a pod it is.
Oh, that's so cool.
Because of how unique their languages are. Whereas if when I've been talking to scientists at Fisheries and Oceans Canada, like James Bilkington, he mentioned that that's a pretty rare thing with southern residents, mm-hmm. and that we don't actually know their language down to an individual or individual matriline level like we do with the northern residents.
Yeah.
So it's just really neat to think of the vocal repertoire of this animal and how complex and sophisticated it is.
That is amazing. And I do love the northern resident vocals, listening in real time to the hydrophones up at Orca Lab. I've been doing that. That predates me coming here. I mean, for me, that goes back to 2009 and spending many days in my office with those hydrophones just waiting for some whales. But incredible summer nights sometimes hearing their vocals bouncing off the canyon, underwater canyon walls, and just really, really complex and different vocals between the different groups up there.
Yeah, I think for me, that was one of the big goosebump moments of working with them for the first time is we'd often do what we call pickling, which is stopping when we drop the hydrophone and listen. And when you hear those, particularly those A-clan calls, I mean, for all those kids who grew up like orca nerds like me watching Free Willy,
yep.
You know, you hear that and the big nostalgic tingles mm-hmm. come and just reminds you of your first love for the animals. And it's all kind of comes back to that classic A-clan call.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we'll post a link to Orca Lab if you are not familiar with their hydrophone network. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out.
So another difference, the northern residents are pretty healthy, robust population.
Yeah,
compared
for sure.
Compared to southern residents.
Yeah, there's been, I mean, despite all their similarities, they've had a lot of different obstacles between the two different ecotypes or types of whales. And with their southern residents, as you guys are well aware, obviously the prey availability is a little more intense for them because of the historic overfishing down here on the coast, the building up of the big cities like Vancouver, Seattle, Victoria, all around these major salmon-bearing rivers like these animals rely on. And then going back to the capture era in the late 60s, early 70s, where southern residents were targeted heavily because of, well, their reliability on where to find them and their ease of access in comparison to the northern residents. So that kind of leaves our southern residents in a pretty precarious position. But for the northern residents, often spending most of their lives in more remote parts of the coast, they typically are exposed to less fishing pressure, less toxins, and like I mentioned, back in the late 60s and 70s, less influence from the captivity era.
Yeah, the southern residents were pounded much more during the captures than the northern residents. So you've been able to get out there and tell us about some of the field work you've done with northern residents.
Yeah, well, our field work, which I'm sure we'll get into a bit more in a little bit, but it's really not focused on any one type of whale. It's more, we're looking at sort of a baseline of what's happening in the Salish Sea in the winter and which whales are here. And I guess more importantly, what's bringing them here and where exactly here is, because we do know, at least for the southern residents, that varies a lot between summer and winter. And as we can see from the northern residents, it seems to be the same because we never see these guys down here in the summertime. So we're just kind of hoping to answer what's bringing these whales here, because it is a big hole in the recovery strategies for both northern and southern resident killer whales. So we've been kind of working opportunistically. And then when I heard there were northern residents in Howe Sound, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Maybe if they stick around for a bit, we'll go for it. And then I think it was like Monday. I'm like, oh, should we go? There hasn't been any reports. You know what? We'll just hold off. And then of course, Tuesday, the report comes in there in Howe Sound. So I'm just thinking, I should have gone on Monday, but we rolled. I think we got the report at like 11 and we were off the dock by 12:30. And we're not doing 30 knots like you, Jeff. We're doing 20, 22. So it took us a little bit longer to get there, but we were lucky to catch up on with them late Tuesday afternoon in up in Howe Sound off kind of southern Anvil Island and Pam Rocks. And it was really interesting because we found them, and initially all the A23s and all the A25s were together, and they were just doing these big long dives. And we managed to photo ID all of those guys. And then we noticed the A42s were about half a mile to the south. And they were all together and all diving together. So we went over there and they would kind of come up and they'd be all sporadic in one area. And then they'd start charging one direction. And so they'd go on a dive and I'd keep going that direction, as you often do when you're following whales. You anticipate where they're going to come up next time. But then sure enough, they'd come up all the way behind me.
Of course. Cool.
And I'd go back there, and that happened a couple of times before I noticed that, looking at the chart and looking at the bathymetry, that they seem to be focusing their area around this kind of pinnacle where the water went from really deep to shallow pretty quickly. And so the next time they dove, I just sat there right on the pinnacle. And sure enough, next time they came up, they were just right there. And it looked like they were all kind of sharing food and feeding together. So we managed to move in there, and we could see, once the whales dove, we move in and we could see all the scales and tissue. We managed to get a couple of prey samples from them on that particular day. So considering we got there late in the afternoon, we had like an hour to work with. I was really excited to get a prey sample because, as you know, when you're with these animals, they can be here one day and then the next day be 100 miles away and sure. you won't see them again. So we didn't know if we were going to get another chance. So I was pretty stoked to be able to get those prey samples right away. And we got an eDNA sample from Surge as well. So I was pretty stoked about that.
Oh, that's awesome.
And for those listeners who don't know what eDNA is, do you want to kind of give a little background on that and what you've been collecting and what you could hope to learn from eDNA?
Yeah, for sure. So environmental DNA is a way of collecting genetic information from animals without having any invasive methods like biopsies. And it's been used for different things like fish and larger whales in the past, but it's never been used for killer whales before. And the director of our program at OceanWise, Dr. Chloe Robinson, she has her PhD in this field. So she's kind of set us on this path of finding out how this can work as a conservation tool for killer whales. First of all, if it works at all, and then how can we use it? So last year when we started the project, it was just a baseline. So we kind of started from scratch, and all we did was grab these 1 liter jugs and literally scoop the water right from after a whale dove. They leave this flat patch of water on the surface called a fluke print. And we can scoop that water. And then hopefully we're collecting, whether it be skin cells or little fragments of fecal matter, and being able to extract DNA from that. So last year when we did it, we were just doing this baseline study. So we scooped 1 liter of water, we froze it, and then it went to our lab, was thawed out, and just run through the analysis process there. And so the methods weren't too refined at that point, but we still had about just over 40% of all the samples working, which was for killer whale DNA, which was That's pretty exciting considering that it was very, very baseline. So this year we really ramped up our methods, and we started collecting more than double the amount of water. And also we got a special eDNA filtering machine. So right away after it comes on board, we filter it right away. And then it goes into a vacuum sealed bag and sent off to our genetics lab. So hopefully this year, I'm hoping that we get a much higher success rate. And if we do, we can continue to refine those methods until it's almost a perfect match with getting biopsies, which the nice thing about when we're working with southern residents in particular is that all these whales have been genetically mapped already. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we're starting from scratch. Like, I'll see J47, he'll be on his own. He goes on a dive. I scoop that water. We make a note in the iPad. This was J47. This is how long he dove before we got the sample, et cetera. And then once we get the results from that, we can actually compare that with his genetic profile. So whether the eDNA sample we got matches his genetic profile. And so it's kind of a nice way to confirm what you're doing is actually working.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And as far as moving forward, I mean, it's kind of nice to move away from darting the animals. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's been an effective way for a long time, but we always try to get better and do things better. So this is kind of a step in that direction. And then hopefully it makes life easier for getting questions answered, like who are the dads? Yeah. I mean, getting paternity information on these animals would be amazing without having to biopsy the entire population.
Right.
And you're doing this with big killer whales as well, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, we're doing it with big killer whales. And then there's all kinds of things. Like once we get the methods refined, we'll be able to test all different ways of how to use eDNA with killer whales. So for example, with southern residents, for example, when you're trying to get prey samples, especially in the winter, it's really difficult because they're often spread out in ones and twos, and they're often doing a lot of their foraging in really deep water going after winter springs. So they go down on a dive, they make their kill, they eat, and then when they come to the surface, they're kind of on the move again. So it's really hard for you to get tissue or scale samples. But what we're hoping and what we're doing now is when we see a prey event and we collect a prey sample, we're also collecting an eDNA sample. So we're hoping moving forward that we'll be able to see a really strong salmon primer on that eDNA sample and be able to correlate that with a predation event so that we can just, you know, if J22 comes up after what looked like a foraging dive, we can scoop her eDNA and be able to possibly tell if there was actually a foraging event and what type of fish that was.
That's amazing.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I did notice in I think it was your social media post, I think maybe on your Instagram, talking about how we're so used to watching the southern residents when they're foraging and so spread out in ones or twos and noticing different behavior from the northern residents when they're foraging is more of a, more in a group.
I think, yeah, for sure. I think even the time I spent with the northern residents on the north coast of BC, when we were doing our photogrammetry work up there, they were often like the southern residents spread out foraging in ones and twos. But on this particular day in Howe Sound, it seemed, like I mentioned, they were all diving as this big unit and then coming up, seemingly circling in one area, sharing, and then diving again altogether. So it'll be interesting to see what they are feeding on.
Yeah.
But Nick Templeman, who you guys know, he operates in Campbell River, he spent a long time watching northern residents, and he said that he commented on my post and said that he noticed that the A5s had done that quite a bit around Campbell River.
Interesting.
And he had mentioned that they were doing it on top of pinnacles, which I hadn't even mentioned in my post, which is exactly what I saw. So obviously they have something figured out there.
That's really interesting.
Cool. Fascinating.
Very cool. And and whatever it is that they're eating up there, I mean, they've been up there for a little while off of Howe Sound. And but I don't remember, this is the first time maybe I haven't been paying attention, but this is the first time that I've heard the A23s and A25s down there with the A42s. But
I'm sure
might be me, but I don't remember them being down there.
I'm sure they have in the past, but you're right, though, over the last few years, especially, it's been mostly the A42s, if not only the A42s. I think the A23s and A25s are sometimes seen around Powell River or Lund, which, for those who don't know, it's a bit further west, northwest. But the A42s are the more regular ones to come visit this area. But the fact that all 16 of them are staying here for such a prolonged amount of time, I guess, can only be good news. And the amount of time we spent with them over those 2 days, we would drop the hydrophone, and it was pretty cute, actually. Like A121 and A126, the two youngsters were just, it almost seemed like our version of Goo Goo Gagas. It wasn't like those nice A-clan calls. It was just a lot of squawking and chirping, but nonstop echolocation.
Wow.
And then they would stop. They'd find this kind of good area of food, and they just forage all together for a little bit, and then they'd keep on rolling. So they're obviously finding a lot of food there, and we got 4 prey samples over that time, over the 2 days. So it'll be nice to see once we give that to DFO and their genetics analysis lab to see what comes back from that and what exactly they're feeding on. So I guess the two things is, one, it's really cool that these animals are there and there's food supporting them. And number two is, like, why aren't the southern residents there?
Right.
I was just going to mention that because that's in more of the southern residents' typical range. It's right there off, you know, very close to the Fraser River. And you would think the southern residents would be up in that area, but they're not. It is very interesting.
I was thinking about this because often all I do is sit around and think about whale stuff. But, you know, one of the big conservation issues with the southern residents not getting enough food is some of the runs of salmon that come in the summertime are coming over the top of the island and coming down towards the Fraser. And so northern residents are getting access to them first. And so by the time they get here, there's not as many for the southerns. I'm wondering if the southerns, they seem to be, although we haven't figured out exactly where yet, that's going to be one of the goals of our winter work, is to figure out these exact foraging locations for southern residents in the winter, which I think are up off Texada, kind of between there and Middle Natch, somewhere in there. I wonder if they're getting the same fish that these northern residents are getting, but just on their way down. So anyway, who knows? We'll see. Hopefully we can get prey samples from them as well as the northerns and compare all these things.
So it's so interesting. Yeah. And just, I can't really just explain why, but there's, at least for me, there's just something really magical about the northern resident killer whales. They're, and I don't know, maybe it's because I had a really epic experience with them. It's one of my first whale experiences, but they're just, and maybe it's also because it's, they're this robust, growing, healthy population, but they're really incredible.
They are really cool whales. I think they're a pretty special type of killer whale. I think there's all the history that goes behind them, so they kind of mean that much more to people. But also, they seem to be like very gentle and even more cuddly than other killer whales with one another.
Yeah,
very family oriented. And you know, with the southern residents, which can be the same way sometimes, I think the southern residents are, there's always sort of an undertone of sadness watching them because of what they're going through and what they've gone through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas with the northern residents, this is like a population that's been growing and is at a relatively healthy number and doing quite well. And they seem to be, I don't know, more confident, maybe just healthy whales. You know, with the southern residents, with so many of them being removed during the captivity era, it kind of left almost this broken population where you have so many whales that have not grown up with mothers and had to grow up with aunties and kind of these broken sort of family groups, whereas there seems to be a lot more stability in the northern resident group.
Sure.
And maybe that just creates more, whatever it is, inquisitiveness or time for cuddling and playing.
Yeah, they were kind of like that when we saw them yesterday. So we didn't mention this yet. And Gary, I appreciate you you rooting me on yesterday. we were in the right place at the right time to, basically the way I put it on the boat, we were throwing a Hail Mary. There were no other whale reports nearby. There were a lot of whale reports out of our range. And so I started thinking, like, we're not going to see whales today, which happens sometimes, and there's great wildlife this time of year. But we decided to go for it. There was a report of the northern residents on the just south of Bowen Island, and decided to extend our tour and go for it. And we were kind of afraid because my biggest fear was
running out of fuel.
Well, it wasn't, I was pretty confident with the fuel. What I didn't want to happen, because when we decided to do this, we were already an hour into our tour and we were an hour and 15 minutes away from the report. And there were no other boats with them. And my biggest fear was we were going to go all the way up there and we weren't going to be able to find them. Like, either they changed direction or
sure,
they went like up Howe Sound at 10 knots and they were too far from, they were going to be way too far at that point. And so I even texted you, Gary. I said, is this, am I being stupid?
And I think I said, like, chasing a whale report. That's never stupid.
Right. Well, chasing a rare northern resident killer whale report.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
But it worked out, and it was, my adrenaline is still going 24 hours later, after seeing them. First of all, the beauty of that area up there is staggering, and the just seeing those whales, really tight groups, very, lots of surface time, very rolly, with each other, very spy hoppy. And Sarah, this was your
spy hops?
Lots of spy hops. And I again got yelled at because Sarah took a turn at the helm. And then she's screaming. She's like, every time I take the helm, you get a spy hop photo.
It's true.
It is true. But I like that. But Sarah, this was your first ever.
It was.
Time.
And I didn't
Northern
think
Residence.
It was going to happen.
Yeah. You've been talking about it for years. Yeah. I've been hearing you talk about how someday you need to see Northern Residence.
Yeah. Well, I went up to the North Island, North Vancouver Island in 2010 and missed them. And I've, you know, not tried that hard since then because I would have seen them. But I've been trying since then and always just kind of missed them. So it was really, I'm still like in shock.
Yeah.
I finally got it.
I was surprised to hear that. I'm pretty excited for you. Yeah. You got to see them. I'm like, Jeff, it was the first time for you in quite a few years, right? And wasn't your...
Yeah, I went up to Johnstone Strait for 4 days in 2009. And that was, I did go whale watching off of Victoria before I went up there. That was my very first time seeing Southern Residents off Victoria. And that was my very first wild killer whale. It was my first wild killer whale experience. And then I went up to Johnstone Strait. And when I was up there, we spent 4 days kayaking up there and had that was really a life-changing experience for me. We were out on our kayaks, and at this point in the day, most of the group I was with, they went for a hike, and we had been watching whales going by, and it's like, I'm not here to go hiking. I'm here for whales. And so we went out with two other people and a guide, and we were just floating out. Johnstone Strait at this point, it was just total glass. And we were floating, watching a parade of whales going by, probably half a mile away from us. And then two of the whales made a hard turn and just started coming straight towards us. And we had about a 5-minute encounter where this sprouting male was just coming up in front of us, behind us, next to us, 10 or 15 feet off our kayak. And I knew it in the moments that followed. That encounter literally changed the entire trajectory of my life. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now without that encounter. And so that was in 2009. That I did get an ID on that whale later on. I didn't do the IDs, but I sent it in. I can't even remember where I sent it in. But somebody, I got a long email back that it was A61 Surge and he was sprouting. And we got to see him yesterday and I had not seen him since then.
And he's gotten a little bit bigger since then. Oh,
he's a big 30-year-old robust male. And my first... it was awesome. When we first got on scene and ID'd where he was, and Sarah came up and took the helm and said, you know, get outside and go take some pictures. And I was just overcome with, all I could think of was, I just wanted to say to him, hey, dude, look what I've done because of you. Look what I've done with my life and how much you've changed me. And I think that, you know, people ask us all the time on the boat, who's your favorite whale? And that's an easy one for me. I mean, I can't point to a specific whale other than him of somebody who's had a dramatic impact on my life. But yeah, he's big.
So Gary, I told Jeff he needs to get a tattoo of Surge.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
For I'm sure. In.
And one other special whale that we saw yesterday, and we did get into at least one Northern Resident in detail on a past episode. And that was the episode about Corky. Mm-hmm. And the film about Corky, and Corky's younger brother was there yesterday.
Yep. Fife.
Yeah. But she was captured before he was born, but he was there yesterday and he's also a big whale.
Yep.
Yeah. It's, Tasley, my partner Tasley, she spent, she spent some time with Corky, at SeaWorld, back when she was a kid. And, started to follow her online and see all the trainer's comments about her, and going back to our conversation earlier about how the northern residents just seem a bit different. It seemed like more gentle in a way. Mm-hmm. She told me that all the trainers used to say that, or probably still do, is when there's a new whale that comes in, they all get put with Corky first, because she's the most gentle and patient whale, rather than other whales that will sometimes sort of maybe beat up on a newcomer or bite or get territorial. She's always very patient, and even with new trainers, they used to always work with Corky first, mm-hmm. because she was the most patient with the trainers as well, which I think is just sort of a perfect sort of synopsis of the northern residents in general. It's just,
That's
they just
amazing.
Seem to be this really kind of peaceful, patient, beautiful being.
They really are, and they just look so unique. And I know I say that, and there's a lot of people that are like, a killer whale's a killer whale. They all look the same, but their fins are so unique compared to any other whales I've seen. And just seeing, like, you know, I've seen the ID photos, I've seen other people's photos, but seeing them in person, like, they're so cool.
Yeah, I mean, A79.
Oh, yeah.
That whale, there's no other whale that looks like that besides the northern resident.
Yeah.
That big old hook.
And there was one photo from yesterday. One of them has a freckle, but I don't know who that is.
I didn't even see the breach, so I don't know.
Saw the splash, though, right?
I saw one splash, and then I didn't even see the splash on the other one.
After the breach.
After the breach. But, yeah, there's...
After
I think
the breach, there it is.
Yeah, one of the younger animal, not young, but a female or a younger animal has a freckle on the chin. But I don't know who.
Yeah, we had a pretty cool moment with them because the SCANA, the research boat that we use at Oceanwise, its main job from, like, 2014 to 2022, I should say, was photogrammetry, working with northern residents off the north coast.
Oh.
So that for every summer, this boat would be up there working around the whales, doing the drone work. So for those that don't know, these whales, they're pretty smart and they remember. Mm-hmm. And even going back to the capture era, you guys know the story of the southern residents that knew the tones of the vessels that were coming to catch them, right? And they would show different behavior around those vessels than say the average fishing boat. So I wonder if they kind of know the specific pitches of different boats that they encounter quite a bit, because when we first found them last week, two of the youngsters kind of broke off and came straight over the boat and kind of did a up on their side, looking up sort of thing as they did a flyby, almost like, where have you been? We haven't seen you for a while. I mean, that's just probably me anthropomorphizing, but still, it felt pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting that kind of like nod of recognition.
That's awesome.
Gary, this is your third season with, third year with Oceanwise, or has more time passed than that?
No, it's I've been with them for 3 years, and the first year was all focused on photogrammetry, so using drones to fly over the whales and do health assessments using aerial photography. But the goal of that program was to always be sort of a 10-year data collection window, and then we kind of move on. And so now at the end of that 10-year data collection, we had to kind of think of new projects, and that's where the winter work really came in to try to address a big hole in the recovery strategy. So pretty excited. I love being out there in the winter. I mean, it's not always fun when it's minus 15 like it was earlier this winter, but it's just quiet out there and there's lots going on. There's lots of bigs, and the residents seem to be around a lot more in the winter now. So it's just kind of a pretty cool spot. And even in the early winter, the humpbacks are just insane up until about January. So,
yeah, when we were in Australia, I still had one eye on the whale watching app up here, and was amazed how many whales were around this winter, how many, especially bigs, how many were in the area all January and February.
And then you get those matrix lines, right? Like the T-73As who come in here seemingly more often in the wintertime, and there's other ones as well. So it's kind of cool to be out there and seeing the seasonal change in diet, distribution, and what individuals are here. and the humpbacks. Like last year, we're just about to go to Hornby Island for the herring spawn again. So we're going there March 8th.
Very
cool. To spend some time there and see what's going on. Like last year, we got there and on our first day, we had this young little humpback whale on our way into the harbor. We saw it. It was in about 25 feet of water. And all of a sudden, it just started lunging on all the herring that were getting ready to spawn. And, you know, this was the first time that that had ever been documented of a humpback whale feeding on the herring during the spawn in the Strait of Georgia.
Wow.
So, you know, just being out there to be able to see these things and document them, I think it's going to be important moving forward to get a much better picture of exactly what these animals are doing throughout the entire year rather than just kind of a snapshot of the summer.
Yeah, absolutely. Because winter historically has been a window, you know, where we just don't know what's going on and who's around and what's happening. And of course, things have changed over the decades, but it's really important work to be able to be out there and kind of see what really is happening.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's an exciting time because winter, like you said, winter whales used to be really rare to see whales during the winter months, but now it's becoming so much more common and it's changing that it's cool to document and it's exciting because I also think as part of that, we are going to start seeing humpbacks more often in the winter, especially juveniles and young ones that aren't going to the breeding waters.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing them. There seems to be kind of a short window where there's a few here before they all start to come back. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, Monica Weiland, who has had on a couple of times at the Orca Behavior Institute, she sent me this graph. I think it was a year ago or so. It showed sort of, I can't remember if it was southern residents or just J-POD specifically, but their abundance in the Salish Sea summer compared to winter over the last 10 years, I think it was. And it was amazing to see the huge drop in summer presence and the huge increase mm-hmm. to almost every day of the month in winter. So obviously there's a need there to understand why that is.
Sure. So you're doing this winter project where you're looking at whales kind of present in the Salish Sea, how things are changing. What other projects are you working on? Do you have anything upcoming that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, so our winter work should wrap up. Well, it's going to wrap up near the end of March. And after we go up to Hornby Island for the herring spawn, and then we'll be actually heading down to California to do a collaborative effort with the California Killer Whale Project, showing them the eDNA side of things and how to collect it down there from big killer whales, with the idea being that I mentioned earlier when we were chatting about what are the other possibilities of collecting eDNA and whether we can suss out prey or individual, you know, paternity, all that kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. one of the other things is we're looking at skin microbiomes of killer whales, because we've noticed there has been a paper published fairly recently about skin lesions on southern resident killer mm-hmm. whales. So we'd like to be able to see if we can assess skin microbiomes through environmental DNA. And that's one of the pilot projects that we have coming up here that we're going to be doing in collaboration with the California Killer Whale Project.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
That sounds awesome.
And you'll be down there, hopefully during the...
Be down there...
April and May when the gray whales are coming through. And
we'll be down there for a couple of weeks in April.
Nice.
Very, very awesome. I need to get back down there.
Yeah, me too. Yep. It's been too long.
It's been, I think, like 5 years.
Yeah, 2019, I think.
You both have had your fill of killer whale carnage after Australia. So.
Can you ever have too much?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Good point.
Yeah, I still have other killer whale populations I got to see. I still haven't seen offshores.
Yeah?
ETPs? Yeah, me neither. That's on the bucket list.
You've seen ETPs. Let's, you got ETPs out there in Mexico, didn't
you? Yeah, you saw ETPs this year, didn't you?
Yeah, that was amazing. That was such a good score. I mean, Ivan Reef, who lives there on Samoan Island, the guy is just, I mean, I can't believe how good his eyes are. He found basically everything on that trip. We'd be scanning and he'd be like, oh, I got something. I'm like, where? 11 o'clock. And I'm scanning and scanning and then running and running. And about 4 or 5 miles later, I'm like, oh yeah, there it is. he sees it from so far away. So he was great to have on board and he found those killer whales. And we were just over the moon that we managed to find killer whales in the Sea of Cortez. But
yeah, that's amazing.
That's incredible.
There's been some amazing encounters down there this year. It's making me want to go spend more time down there.
I know. I feel you.
Yeah.
So you, and then you'll be back up here and out on the water, like North Island, down here.
In the summertime, we have a project going on with the Port of Vancouver, looking at marine biodiversity in general, which we're going to be doing sampling every other month. So we'll be out there doing that with eDNA collection. But our main dedicated whale work is going to be focused on in the winter months.
Sweet.
So
that's awesome.
We won't be on the water quite as much in the summer.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you out there when you are out there. And
Me too.
And the rest of this winter and next winter.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have a catch up in person soon, guys.
Yeah, for sure. This year I gotta definitely come over.
No, we should go over. We should.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah, we'll definitely plan a day or two and get together over there. Maybe we'll grab a rental over on Bowen Island or something, and I'll head over there.
Let's do it.
Awesome. Gary, it's always great to see you and always great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. It was fun chat.
So it is always good to have Gary on board on the show.
And yeah, he's always a wealth of information and just always doing cool things too.
Always doing very cool things. The eDNA stuff is fascinating, and it's going to be really cool to see where that goes.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting. And honestly, like, great, what a great tool if it pans out to be just as effective as doing biopsy sampling. Like, that would be amazing.
Incredible. And I do appreciate his encouragement yesterday to go for it and go see the northern residents.
Yeah, it was a little like touch and go at the beginning when we were in Swanson Channel and, you know, we all convened at the helm.
Mapped it out and said
we looked at our fuel gauge.
I think at that point we were about 40 miles out, 35 miles out from there. And yeah, just decided like you said, either we go for it or we don't, something to that extent. And then I said, this is a Hail Mary. And if the Hail Mary is successful, it's like the Cleveland Browns winning the Super Bowl.
Yeah. And really, like, what I think I mentioned was, like, we have to be willing to go and not find them.
Yeah.
Right? Because we had no idea, like, what it was like up there, how close to shore they were, how far offshore they were, how fast they were going, what the landscape looked like. Because we've never been there. So we had to be willing to take that chance to go and not find them. And if we were okay with that, then it was something I think worth doing. And I'm glad we did it.
And I think we did a really good job of, like, not talking about it on the way up, or when we were talking about it, talking if we find them, not when we find them.
Right.
We did a great job of not jinxing it. I physically had butterflies.
Oh, me too.
I was so nervous. Yep, me too. Mostly about not being able to find them or taking a long time to find them. And then, you know, we had a window of time
at
which point we had to turn around and come home, because we were a good hour and a half plus away from home up there. And so there was only so much time we could spend looking for them before we'd had to turn. We really were fortunate because we found them within 5 minutes of getting there.
I would say within a minute.
Yeah, it was fast. I mean, you were on the bow, and I told you I was going to slow down a mile from shore, which I did, and we were pointed at shore, and you saw two fishing boats, and you're like, I got blows.
That was pretty cool, actually.
That was awesome. there was so much relief and excitement in that moment when we knew we had them.
Yeah. I mean, it's always just, there's something about it when you're the first one to spot whales. There's like an internal rush.
Always adrenaline.
And to have that and know who these whales were that we were about to see just made it that much better.
Yeah, and it didn't get lost on me yesterday of seeing A61 and the Northern Residents that I haven't seen them since 2009, and I'm out on the water almost every day and have closer access to going to areas where their presence is more frequent, yet I still haven't seen them since 2009. And it didn't get lost on me that who knows where, when, and if ever again. And so I really was taking in the moments yesterday.
Yeah, and like Gary mentioned earlier, with kind of growing up on these books, that really it started with The Northern Residence. Orca the Whale Called Killer was one of the first books that I read about killer whales. And, you know, it was kind of detailing this whole natural history about APOD, you know, all the clans, all the Northern Resident clans and the researchers behind them and everything that happened to them. And that's what I grew up with, and Southern Residents as well. But that book stands out in my mind. And if finally, after many decades, get to see them was really like, I mean, still hasn't quite sunk in.
Yeah, I know. Well, who knows? We might see them sooner than later. And we'll definitely be going back up in that direction on one of our all-day tours, I would imagine. It's very beautiful up there.
Yeah, stunning.
And in the meantime, you know, we will follow up with Gary on a future episode, and he can keep us posted on what's happening with the eDNA work.
Yeah, yep. I look forward to hearing how that goes. Well, before we sign off, we have our upcoming photography workshop in August. Still have some space available on that. And our humpback whale trip to the Dominican Republic in next year has sold out, amazingly enough. That is completely filled. But we are taking wait list, just in case we have some people that end up not being able to go. If you're interested in going, if you'd like more information, please still reach out to us. We'll probably be putting together future trips to the DR to go out with Conscious Breath Adventures. But even for this next year, if you are interested in going and being on the wait list, definitely let us know.
And we're running tours daily starting next weekend up here in the Salish Sea out of Friday Harbor. So you come on out of the water with Sarah and I. And
Jeff, not till late March because he's abandoning me.
Oh, I'll be back. And we'll post some photos from yesterday's encounter with the Northern Residents in the show notes. And we will talk to you guys soon. And in the meantime, stay safe out there.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of After the Breach podcast. If you've enjoyed it and want to help us out, please share this with your friends, family, and any other whale-loving folks you can think of. We would also love to hear your feedback, so please leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have topics you're interested in and would like to hear on the show, please send us an email. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can find us on Instagram as @AfterTheBreach and on Facebook as After the Breach Podcast. And if you'd like to go whale watching with us, then come on up to San Juan Island, Washington State. We run tours with Maya's Legacy Whale Watching, departing just steps away from the ferry landing in beautiful downtown Friday Harbor. It's a great destination for a day trip or multiple days and offers some of the best whale and wildlife viewing in the world. We would love to take you out on the water to see the amazing whales we talk about on our podcast. You can book a tour through the company website at www.sjiwhalewatch.com and make sure to mention you're a podcast listener when you book. Thanks again for listening, and remember, stay safe out there.